There are 49 million people in the United States who are over 65, 74 million under 18. So, 37% of the population, right, may not have this ability to have or afford, the technology to utilize, right, and take advantage of all the technology that feeds sort of a smart city, an optimal smart city system. Also keep in mind that, 40 million people live in poverty. Poverty is defined as a one-person household earning $15,000 a year. Think about that. Can you, as a single person, live on $15,000 per year? And if you can, can you afford to own a smartphone, a computer, pay for an internet, etc., that would take advantage of a smart city? So if you have a smart city system, it may not allow everyone to participate in it. So there's a certain inequality of our society that is a larger question to answer, as opposed to just thinking about, oh, technology solves every problem. Third set of questions look at some of these other issues that I'm alluding to. One is, now there is a lot of co-living residential that's being looked at. How does social distancing affect that in terms of people needing their own space and creating social distancing? How does the current issue impact residential design, campuses and office culture, etc.? So already campuses and workplaces are beginning to address that, again, sort of the work at home, hybrid work situation is, one way that's addressing social distancing. But one campus, or at least some campuses, is thinking about, well, it'd be good to bring the students back on campus because, I'm a firm believer that college campuses is a very important part of a young person's life. Prior to college, most of you are living at home and being taken care of by your parents. And once you graduate, you expect to go out and be independent in the world and be independent adult. So college, those 4 years, are a really important time to make that transition between sort of dependency at home and being totally independent. And this is the perfect time for you to, experiment, discover things about yourself, discover what you want to do, what you want to be. It should be a nurturing environment that facilitates, the sort of social, academic, recreational pursuits that, that will prepare you to make some decisions of how, you at least make the start, right, into sort of being an adult. So the major issue is, well, we have the social distancing and fear of the virus to bring back students. So how do we sort of accommodate students on campus? Certainly you can create social distancing in classrooms by creating more space, but then dormitories is a big issue. However, if dormitories were more like apartments, then you're no different than anyone else in the city, right? So you can study from home, right, if you need separation. Another way to some campuses I think about is, well, what if we create sort of small families of students there's always a small group of you who live together exclusively, so that you sort of minimize your contacts with outside, etc. So there are, again, other people, more creative people thinking about this. It's trying to find an environment, right, which helps accommodate that. A key issue is, again, social behavior.
This is what $12 an hour gets you.
Oops. If people don't follow the rules of social distancing, you can easily go out and contract something and, you know, bring it back to the classroom, bring it back to your dormitory, bring it back to your little social family, if that's a situation. So again, it requires quite a lot of personal discipline, sort of to monitor yourself, right, in order to participate in a larger community. Now, this gets into a cultural shift, right? Not so much a physical solution now. This gets into sort of culture and social contemplation about how can we live in this sort of a future new normal, right? In a place like Japan, which is a more homogeneous society, you know, it's culturally, I think about, you know, my behavior is affecting my community. So there's more of a sort of community concern that your behavior, your decisions affects your neighbors, your community, your city, your country. So there's more of a concern of being part of, you know, being part of this much larger extended family. Whereas in America, you know, there is more of an individual aspect as opposed to, and you think of, you know, there's lots of talk about, well, you know, rules are confining my liberty, my freedom of doing things, freedom of speaking, freedom of acting. So there needs to be some sort of accommodation, some adaptation, given situation like coronavirus, of being mindful of your neighbors, right? So again, this is part of a larger thinking about design, about thinking about the environment that will affect, you know, our attitude about how we design places, how we think about the application of technology, et cetera. So the next groups of questions actually came from Anne Catherine, which talks about, you know, what are the challenges, well, she directed at me, what do I see as the challenges for the architecture and urban design now and the future? You know, what are sort of some organizational models that we may be thinking about? You know, what are the visionary ideas and, you know, what's the innovation potential? Just to give you a little bit of background about myself, you know, I started off studying electrical engineering because Chinese American boys in the 50s and 60s, you know, that's pretty much written on our birth certificates, you know, thou shalt be an electrical engineer, because there's a lot of, you know, engineering jobs based on a space race and all that. And you're good in math, right? Because you speak English poorly, you know, so perfect for you. But after 2.5 years, I just could not put my mind wrapping around electric circuits. I needed something more tangible. So I dropped out and switched into architecture. But after 2 semesters, I dropped out of that as well, you know, because this was the 60s. You know, this was the time of social exploration and discovery. And I went into fine arts. And it took me 5 years to accumulate enough liberal arts credits in order to graduate with a BA degree, with a minor in literature, math, and physics, you know, because of all my science backgrounds. But I felt that, you know, fine arts was too self-serving. I still wanted something, again, you know, that was more tangibly applicable, you know, in society. and based on my former faculty member suggested I go to graduate school for architecture, which I did at Berkeley on a partial fellowship. You know, got my master's of architecture in 3 years. But while there, I got really interested in about urban design because that social awareness of thinking about beyond that pure object, that object does not exist in a vacuum, that is always surrounded by other things, the environment, the city and people, led me into this great interest in urban design, which again led me back to the East Coast, to Harvard, to the only urban design school at that time to get a master's of architecture in urban design. So I see architecture is purely beyond thinking about architecture, of design that object. And as you pursue, those of you predominantly who are architects, I understand some of you are not, but even to those who are not architects, think beyond just the very specific thing that you're studying and will be planning to do. So an architect looks at, you know, design of the object, but you always have a client, unless, you know, you're independently wealthy. So you have to accommodate someone else's needs and program, translate that need into an object. So now you become, you know, sort of a part analyst, right? That you're accommodating someone else's thoughts, someone else's wishes into a physical design. But then that house or building, whatever, exists on a site. And you have to accommodate the limitation of the site, that the neighbors and the environment. Now all of a sudden you're an urban designer, right? You're thinking about the land, you're thinking about, you know, whatever landscape is on there, you're thinking about separation to the neighbors, how neighbors perceive it, how you can see out and enjoy the sun which rises from the east and settles in the west, etc. Right? So but then, you know, you cannot build anything you want. Right? There are regulations that you have to follow, building, zoning, fire codes, setbacks, height limitations. So now all of a sudden you're an environmentalist, right? Because you have to accommodate these other factors, which goes beyond the building itself, right? The environment. And if you're designing a building for a builder or a university, you have to start thinking about the non-client users, people who come by, who pass by, who use the building, but they don't have a voice, right, in the programming and design of that building. But then in most cases, you don't do the work all by yourself. You work with partners, you know, whether or not they're your team members, your coworkers, engineers and lawyers. So all of a sudden now you're a collaborator. You're a teammate. You supervise people, or you're supporting staff, and you're maybe a technical expert in terms of how you use the equipment. But then if you rise up to run your own firm, or even if you rise up in a managerial position, right, you have to consider practice issues. So all of a sudden, right, you're a business person. Right, you're thinking about payroll, you think about rent, expenses, taxes, insurance, et cetera. Right? So as you design the building, you're thinking about, well, how do I put this building together? And you think about materials. So now all of a sudden, right, you may be a leaf specialist. You're thinking about local materials. You think about renewables. You think about environmentally sourced products. And as you create your design, right, you have to write about it. You might have to write a letter. You might write a proposal. You have to write a report. So all of a sudden, right, you're an author, right? So you have to sort of balance all your skills between just away from design of accommodating all these other things. And as you write, you need to sort of balance, right, points of view, being objective and subjective, sort of a negotiator, right? And in order to run the business or even help whoever runs the business, you know, that you're working for, right, you need to be concerned about, you know, costs, et cetera. So now all of a sudden you're a financial analyst, right? You have to think about the cost of the office, the cost of practice, cost of projects, construction costs, You know, you have a certain fiduciary responsibility to your firm, to your client, et cetera. And in order to find more future work, right, you have to sort of write proposals. Now, all of a sudden, you're a promoter, right? You have to sort of think about writing proposals, how to give presentations, how do you interact with the public if you have a public review process, or you serve on a panel in school or in a conference, and you sort of get some recognition or recognize, you know, others in that role. And you'll be working, as you get more mature, you start working with younger people, or you might have an interest in sort of teaching. So now all of a sudden you're a teacher, and you sort of mentor staff, you mentor students. And it's a way of passing forward your knowledge, your experience of contributing to sort of the larger society. But given, you know, all the commentary and findings in the last few years regarding sexual harassment, civil rights, and even how we tweet, right? You need to become an ethicist, right? You need to sort of be promote truth and honesty and morality to serve as a role model to those around you. And of course, overriding all of this, right, you're a citizen. As an architect, you're a steward of your environment, of the people that you work for. And so you have this sort of civic consciousness that you inherently should have, right, in your sort of contribution, not only to the art, to your own career, but also to society. So there's this huge aspect about being an architect that addresses a lot of these things that we're talking about. And looking beyond, right, the specific physical design issue, thinking about the environment, how can you apply your skills in design of thinking about all these other things and contributing to their realization? Now, there's a big hole in this. The big hole is, no matter how creative we are, right, unless we can get some cooperation from, say, particularly from government, right, or people to adapt, the rest of society to adapt and participate, then everything sort of falls apart. If there's no funding for public transit, no matter how well we design it, how many ideas we come up with, right, it may not get done.
Gary, I actually have a follow-up question that came in from Alexis. Would you be ready to fit that in, seeing that huge big picture that you just painted?
Okay. Well, what was that question would be?
So Alexis is asking, and this really brings all those skills that you're laying out and the collaborative needs, maybe brings them all together into a question, and I'm curious what you think about it. She's asking, how can we as designers and innovators, so already those roles are being addressed, plan for current cities to become safe for everyone and allow for social distancing while avoiding gentrification of poorer and less fortunate communities?
Well,
can that tie in?
Very much so. Again, you know, we can do it several ways, right? We can do it in a very direct way, local way of working with communities directly, and we can try to do it in a larger way of engaging our representatives, engaging, you know, government, right, and promote it, so that the powers that be can help implement these. You know, architecture school doesn't necessarily need to lead to people being an architect. Your ability to understand design, the ability to understand the environment, right, may help you. And if you think of all these other things that I mentioned, right, may lead you to other professions like city planner or mayor, right? So it may lead you to roles where you can have a more effective way of implementing change, right, as opposed to design. So this sort of leads me to sort of Barack Obama's recent speech to graduates, right, where he says, you know, the status quo needs fixing. As we can see and read about, right, government at the highest levels is not responding well to the current emergency, right, as well as to a lot of other things in terms of reducing environmental controls, et cetera, right? So in order for society and democracy to work, you sort of have to think beyond yourself and think about others and seize the initiative, you as young people, more than ever, right? Because people like me, right, in the 70s, right, we sort of like don't really have the time left, or perhaps even the energy or the means, right, to implement some of these, which may take decades. And so it's the young that has that influence. We can talk about, you know, various ways, and I've already touched upon some of the ways of how cities can be made safer and more engaging. But it does require quite a lot of addressing these concerns and to be aware of them and find some way, Alexis, right, to implement these things. So getting back to, say, the smart city sort of theme, right, using technology and all that, and even improving mass transit, right, there's a huge segment of people in the community who may not be able to use, implement, or even understand some of these things that we sitting in sort of the ivory tower of colleges, right, may come up with the best ideas for society, but they are may be available to those who are not in the sort of 40 million poverty, right, or the sort of elderly who, you know, can do not have the means or understanding or the tools to use those things. For example, you know, I'm a first generation American, where my family immigrated from China in the 40s, late 40s. And at that time, there were very few Chinese Americans in the United States. My mother and my brother were, you know, amongst the 6,000 first wave of immigrants permitted to come to America, where for 90 years, there was a law that prevented specifically Chinese from immigrating to America. And it was my father who was already here who brought my mother and my brother here. But then, you know, abandoned us after a year I was born. So here was my mother, an illiterate who could not read or write in any language, single mother, penniless, right, in a strange country, to make a living. Now, in those days, there was so little of us in America. There was only like 20,000 Asians and 8 million people in New York City where, you know, we lived, which is like a lecture hall of 368 students and one Chinese student in there. That's how few we were. So there were no social programs that can help immigrants like my mother and my brother and me. And even if there were, my mother would not have been able to communicate with them. No translators, no nothing, right? So she was totally on her own. So getting back to the smart city and other programs such as this, how can someone like my mother and other immigrants today, which actually have more social programs to help them, how can they actually afford and participate and benefit from so many of these things, right, that are more focus, right, on sort of the larger group, right, the other sort of 60%, right, who might have access to the finances and means to have these things. So that's the large issue, the big inequality issue here in America, that where the top 1% earns more than the whole bottom 60% of the entire population. So how can we make these programs? How can we encourage decision makers and government, right, to make such things more available to those who, A, don't have the means to participate and may not have the knowledge, or thinking about more about spending, buying money for food than they would about, you know, saving some tree out in the backyard, right?
So this will be actually a very good question for our speaker, Ed One, who does smart city apps and has, I think, worked on trying to integrate and approach communities and community members who are less tech savvy. There is a follow-up question from Bradley, which I want to pass on to you. And I don't know, Larry, if you can see the chat where these questions are popping up. I'm going to read it to you. What has been the most influential piece or pieces of architecture and design that you think have brought communities of different races and cultures together? So it's sort of addressing the that allows culture.
You froze a little. I missed the last part of your question. Yeah.
Read it again.
There's a little piano playing.
Pieces of architecture and design. Well, can you the chat, Larry?
Yeah,
I'll click on the little chat button on the bottom.
Yeah. I'll address it based on the chat because I sort of lost your audio. Yeah.
Thank you. Coming in and out.
Well, again, this is the great advantage of cities, right? Because it has a lot of institutions, if you sort of put that in brackets, right? Or community, or places where community can come together, right? So like libraries, schools, supermarkets, right? Where most anyone can go, everyone participates in, where people can come together. And I've recently completed a master plan for a new city in Malaysia for 2 million people. And in Malaysia, you know, the population is broken down almost, you know, the three large subgroups, the Malay, which is a Muslim culture, 60%, Chinese, which is 25%, and East Indian, 15%. And there's always a big question about, you know, how can we bring these people together? Because, you know, they're all different religions and they all, you know, certainly try to keep amongst themselves because, you know, the government is, while they speak about unifying people, that really doesn't, hasn't yet successfully brought them together. So again, schools, supermarkets, libraries, where people come together, and that's where they talk. You know, there's so many cereal boxes here. You know, I don't know which one to choose. And you strike up a conversation, right, between people, or the kids who know nothing about, you know, race, play together, and you know, that's where, you know, they begin to have this interaction. So I think that it's those things where people are brought together, you know, playgrounds, sports events, right, where people naturally participate in without even thinking about, you know, where they're from, what they are. Well, hopefully they don't. Although certainly COVID-19 has sort of expanded upon, you know, the racism issue, particularly xenophobia, about, you know, where the virus came from, and therefore, you know, people are blame just based on how they look, right?
Well, that's where maybe social distancing makes it actually harder. So when you're saying we used to be able to chat easily in the library at the shelf or in the supermarket, now we're supposed to not get very close. So there is sort of an obstacle set up with the distancing.
You can still have a pretty good conversation 6 feet apart, and we're certainly doing it here online, right? So, if there's a will, there's a way. So the big issue is that will. Are we interested? Do we want to learn? Do we want to look beyond, right, our own prejudices? Do we want to look beyond what is visible? You know, do we want to look beyond the cover of the book and read what's inside the book? Right.
That's true. Well, Larry, we have 10 minutes left. So I don't know if we want to do the experiment of everybody turning their cameras on so we can have a few questions, but also see who's in the room, so to speak.
Well, first of all, I don't know about your time, but, you know, I'm pretty much retired. So, you know, my time is flexible. So don't worry about my time. You know. So I'd be happy to hang around if everyone's interested and have more questions. Yeah. You know.
Thank you. Well, let's see what's coming in. So any more questions about the things Larry has brought up, which are have a lot of social components to them, cultural components to them, and sort of placing architecture and urbanism very much in the non-physical context of things rather than looking at it dealing with objects or dealing with kind of items. There's another one from Alexis. Larry, do you want to read it since I'm cutting in and out?
Sure. When thinking of cities to come around the world, how do you think we could better prepare the citizens within them for situations similar to the one we are currently living in? Is more sanitation precautions or a complete new mindset of how a city and life within it works? Based on all the news, a lot of other places do much better than we are, you know, in terms of how we are addressing the current situation. What some of the other countries have done was, you know, certainly taking control earlier, certainly implementing more testing. You know, it's interesting, a place like South Korea, which was one of the early places where was a hot spot for the pandemic, never had a lockdown. And they've suffered a much lower significant infection rate and deaths because they did a lot of testing in the beginning and were able to sort of naturally separate people from infecting others. So again, part of this is behavior modification, the will of government and people to participate and discipline themselves and follow and recognize that, you know, we're all in this together, right? It sort of reminds me of, again, back to former President Obama's three advices for young people, right? So ground yourself in the actual community and real people. This gets back to Alexis's first question about, you know, how do we sort of be more effective? And this is one way, right, being more local. Raise your activism to the next level. You know, a lot of things, big changes in the last, you know, few decades were based on, you know, significant activism from people. You know, the women's vote started back in 1848, and it took them, you know, nearly 70 years before their allowed to vote was ratified. But it took their activism, nonviolent activism, right, to promote that. Civil Rights Act, right, took 10 years from 1954 to 64. Again, nonviolent activism, right, that made it happen. The students in Vietnam protests in the 60s, you know, that took 75 years for sort of the Vietnam War to end. But again, it took quite a lot of sort of raising your voice, right?
And even those culture shifts are slow, as we see. Nothing happens overnight.
But some of them did happen overnight. The Velvet Revolution in Prague took 1 month. The tearing down of the Berlin Wall in 91 took 3 months. So it is possible, right? So lastly, I'll just end with this, right? He says, find allies in a common cause, right? This gets back to a whole lot of things like, you know, no man is an island, right? All for one and one for all, right? So, you know, architects tend to think of themselves that, you know, I want to do it myself. But you really need, as I pointed out before, right, a lot of other participants, and you're stronger in a group rather than, you know, alone.
Thank you. And this is maybe a good segue into bringing back the Future Lab idea. So some of these things you've brought up are kind of embedded in this idea of this lab, where we're trying to look at other aspects of different professions, not just architecture. There are two last questions before we can maybe fully wrap up with final comments. One is from Monique, asking about this street closures and sort of ad hoc bike lines and changes that are accommodating social distancing right now. What do you think would need to happen from a government policy community and activism perspective to make these maybe permanent, or to make them happen more comprehensively in other places?
Well, all they need to do is just look at the examples that's happening around the world. Cities around the world are already closing their streets, whether it's temporary or permanently. Now, I forget, I think New York is contemplating 70 miles of closed streets, right? And so, you know, that raises all the issues about, you know, how do you service these places and, you know, how to bring people there. So, but given, you know, the 70% reduction of air pollution and the benefits of social distancing and people actually enjoying walking these closed streets, I would say, you know, it's already been practiced. Now it's a question of making them even better.
Mm, yeah, that's very true.
Let's plant grass, et cetera. So, yeah, I think.
Yeah, make them better and safer, maybe also by, you know, building them out more. So I have one last question, which might be a really good wrap-up question by Bradley again. And it says, you brought up how the environment has gotten better slightly since the situation started. Think the environmental concerns have been voiced much more lately. Is there any other societal issue you think the virus has exposed? So that's a good last one, and then we will wrap up.
Yeah, well, you know, xenophobia is definitely one of the, you know, so again, you know, sometimes some of these crises bring out the best in people, right? Like these volunteers in hospitals, right? They're putting themselves at risk every day, every moment of treating people with virus, and they can catch it at any moment. And they're also dying off. You know, doctors and nurses are dying off all over the world, you know. And then it also brings out the worst in people, right? So, you know, one of the questions that Ann Catherine asked, you know, how do I feel about the future? Well, you know, there's a part of me that is optimist, and there's a part of me that's a pessimist, right? The optimist in me is thinking about, you know, we are creative, you know, we can think about design and all that. But as architects, we also train and think about, you know, larger issues. And I pointed out a lot of them already. So that's the optimist in me, right? That we can get beyond this. And we have to think about the glass is always half full, right? We cannot let it defeat us. Otherwise, you know, we're doomed, right? The pessimist in me is, yeah, you know, there's, that, you know, as Obama said, you know, we're lacking in great leadership, right? And the human behavior, right, needs to be addressed, you know, through education, you know, getting people to be less ignorant, et cetera. But we need good role models. We ourselves also need to behave, right, to provide that role model effect, right? So I don't know if you have one last comment, but I do, right? And again, it gets back to Barack Obama, who I admire greatly, you know, he says, you've earned your degree. Now it's up to you to use it, all right? But I kind of like my pet similar comment comes from Uncle Ben from the Spider-Man movie, right? With great power comes great responsibility. You have the ability, right, as a designer, as a way of looking at these larger issues, right? And you should, you know, and so it's part of your responsibility to apply it that way.
Thank you, Larry. That's a fabulous ending. Thank you for joining us. I hope we can lure you back in for some crit sessions and things down the road. So I will be in touch. Thank you very much for your time and for answering all our questions. So
I hope I did it justice, and certainly, you know, best wishes and good luck to all of you, you know,
Thank you very much. Stay healthy, and we'll definitely be in touch and share some of the ideas that come out of this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you.
It's good to meet you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.